Okay, you're live tonight.
All right, we call to order the Planning Commission meeting, Hood River Planning Commission for Tuesday, February 16th. It is 5:31. Over to you, Planning Director, for your update.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any significant updates for the time being. I do expect to have a public hearing with you all. I believe we have March 1st meeting coming up that will include the TSP. Kevin will be providing some updates on that. Then in April, we also have I believe April 5th, we're going to see some quasi-judicial work come in. So
okay.
conditional use approval request that we will present. So a week
ahead. On the 1st, then, we just have TSP, nothing else?
Nothing planned.
Okay.
We have that scheduled possibly for two meetings as well. Right.
Okay. And then the 15th, was that when you were out?
No, I think TSP on that as well.
Okay. So the 1st and the 15th could be TSP, and then the 5th we'll do quasi-judicial.
Yep.
Okay.
And other than minutes, we just have one matter on for tonight, which is missing middle housing.
All right. Any questions? Let's move on to that then.
And I think we have one caller in the panel.
Yeah, I see Greg Crafts and Nancy Roach on the caller panel.
I was thinking about our panelist on the board right now. I don't know if somebody else called in.
Oh, the 503.
Yeah.
310 number. Who's that?
This is Erica. I just called in.
All right.
Thank you.
Hey, Erica.
Thank you.
Thanks for that.
Yeah.
That just helps.
Sorry, I had to figure out how to unmute from the phone.
you're in attendance, so that's good that we have that on the record.
Yes, I am here.
Okay. So I'm interested in how we should run through the comments. So Dustin, you have updated the middle housing code based on our conversations. You've updated and highlighted some areas. Shall we, as we go through the document, as we go down through the document, should we try and have a conversation and gain agreement before we move down the document, or do we want to run through the entire document and then deliberate at the end? I feel like we've tried different approaches and I'm not sure which works better, but it's been a bit of a challenge to get through the document and make sure that we've all had everybody weigh in. I'm open to suggestions.
I'll make a comment. I feel like I organize my notes somewhat in the document flow order. And
yeah.
Then when we go back to the end, we just kind of pass by some things that were maybe smaller details or stuff I wanted to discuss with each item because we don't really stick around there. So I might suggest that we tackle it section by section or page by page and discuss. Any other comments?
Others agree with that approach?
Sure, I'm good with that.
Sounds good.
Okay, I think that's a thumbs up from everyone.
Okay.
All right, let's take that approach.
I can begin the share of the document and we can
yep.
peruse through this, and I'll make some call outs where I made some changes to this last version based on your comments at the February 1st meeting.
Okay.
Let me bring that up. Hopefully you see one sheet.
I do.
Yep.
This is the document itself. And then I skipped down to the the section we've been talking about. So I don't feel like we've had any significant discussion up to the lead up of 17.25. There'll be some changes in here for definitions. Included in this section is now a definition, and based at your request, including the previous, this is the methodology of building height for the whole city. This is now an included item. Old building height definition has been struck.
Can I stop you on that? So yeah. I think what we had decided, what we had discussed rather last time was we will keep the height at 28 feet because that's what the rest of the city allows. But I wasn't quite sure that I had bought into the idea of, in this missing middle code, we had talked about a new building height calculation tool. And I think what we were bouncing around was this idea of, you know, should we just let the missing middle housing be the same as the city, which means that we are beholden to some building height code that isn't optimal and can be misinterpreted or what's the word? And so right now, you know, you had put in some diagrams that actually brought us into a better place of saying this is what a 28-foot building should allow. Now that we've gone back to the broader city's view, we've also taken away that restriction. Does that make sense to everybody? Are you following?
Yeah, I left there with the and I was kind of the one I think who drove a little bit of a commentary on this. My thinking is that I've had on the top of my agenda for a long time that we actually just go in and fix the city's building height measurement standard and definition.
Yeah.
And I said, let's just stick that thing on our agenda as quickly as possible and not have to deal with two separate things and figure it out once and for all and keep it in one place versus having it here. Then we change the city. Then we got to go back and change this. I mean, I feel like it's going to be confusing for everybody if we have two different definitions, depending on what you're doing.
So I think that was how it ended up this way. What would be the risks here, Dustin? If we leave this, we could just have a rash of until we change the city, you know, there's a chance that 28 feet isn't 28 feet for this middle missing.
Yeah, the change here reflects just the readoption of the basic building height from the rest of the city.
Yeah.
So rather than using a post-development methodology and the 25-foot measure to the ridge, this goes back to pre-development grade and possibilities of where we have slope sites of three-story plus. I mean, that's the significance of keeping it from where it was to where it is now.
But if we try to get this on the agenda, what does that look like? We wanted to get the fixing of the building code citywide for the height on the agenda. How soon could we do that?
Probably not soon, because I'm going to move on to, well, what we will have is an audit this year in the work plan and legislative. We're going to have an audit of the entire code, which will include that. I don't have a plan or a project that's queued up to dial into building height alone as a standalone code amendment, legislative change.
I thought we, like, as the commission, we called that out as one of our top priorities.
That was in there. That didn't make the project list for the year. It got rolled into a greater code conversation. So what did make it is a reevaluation of zoning code and what would it take to overhaul it?
Okay.
Rather than a narrower fix.
So I guess let me ask one other question before we decide what to do here. So what's the risk if we just take B building height definition out right here and just say reference city code section XYZ. That way, if we update that, we update that. So the two options would be leave the detail in that you had, or two, fall back to the city code. And when that changes, this is corrected.
Yeah, there's really it very little. I mean, if we're gonna, there's very little substantive change if we take this definition out or and refer to city code. This is essentially referring to city code. So the only risk would be if we went back and did a code cleanup and missed it, then we missed it.
I've looked at our code for like 30 years and we said we were never going to miss a code cleanup and that, and we can't. So I'm all for sticking stuff in one place. And I would say the same about the floor area ratio definition, defining it in two places in this code set. Let's just keep it at one. But that would be my opinion, is that we just leave it at that. So, but that's that's one of many. So,
I think so. Then the issue would be is if we just refer to the city code that basically it'll be open season to use the existing rules until we get around to modifying the city code, and we don't know when it is.
But this matches city code, right? So, I mean, to Bill's point, if we just take this out and say reference city code, it's going to say what we've got here, right?
Yeah, I think issue is just that there's some in the city code based on the pre-existing slope and slope sides, the pre-existing grade, we are ending up with product that's 3 stories tall, 38 feet tall, right? That's what we were trying to avoid with missing middle housing.
Mm-hmm.
At the densities that we're talking about. That's the challenge. Other thoughts from others?
So at this point, I mean, striking it would basically be with no reinsertion would basically mean using the city code. Mm-hmm. Leaving it is the city code. So I think it's in terms of significance, it's just not located in two places.
So. Yeah. When we did part of the city municipal code updates, we apportioned some of those pieces and sent them to council in advance of the other pieces that we delayed. Are those now implemented in city code, or are they still in limbo? And this building height, if it's something that we want to do soon, could it be apportioned out of the rest of the conversation and fast-tracked to city council?
The other pieces did get codified. So we started off with ADU. That's a part of the code. Floor area.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Coverage that's included in the code. Land divisions included in the code. So there's a series of them that are codified and active now.
So why couldn't we do that with the building height one then?
Track it through bandwidth and what's queued up for projects ahead of time.
Yeah.
So I'm going to end up focusing our bandwidth on the entire code and the project list that came out of council for 2021.
I mean, given that, I'm more inclined just to put it in here, put in the change, put the section K back into the description here, and keep missing middle. To this new diagram. Anyone else part of this conversation?
I agree with you, Mark. Given what, I guess, what could happen without leaving it in here, I would rather leave it in, I think, even though it means that when we do change it, we have two places to change it. But I also agree with Bill that the ultimate goal is to get it in one place only. and not separated.
Yeah, I mean, when the rest of the code is codified, can we not come back in here and clean this up and get rid of the duplication?
Or just take it out. Yeah.
Sure. Absolutely. If it was something that we, or it would stay the same, saying this is a product type that we want to have a different measurement. Mm-hmm. I mean, there would be a choice there whether the baseline or underlying code is, I mean, there's a policy decision there of to change it and whether, what parts do we want to change?
Yeah.
I mean, there's going to be some forks in that road. Do we change it for everything? Is it good that we have a universal height for buildings? Does it need to change by zone? Do we want to incentivize more height in certain zones? Do we want to, I mean, those are all policy choices that are going to need to be made before we make a code change.
Right. Do we want to take a vote on this now?
Sure.
All right.
I think the two cases the state are, we put back in section K or we leave it with whatever city code we have at the time.
Excellent. So the two choices are we go to the citywide code, which allows 28 feet based on the existing measurement methodology, or we say we adopt a 28 feet height from the existing city code, but we have a new height calculation methodology. Those are the two options on the table.
Yeah, I think in your last discussion, there was the first one of the ideas was using the new methodology, but upping it to 28 feet rather than 25.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. Yeah, that was my option B.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I would vote for option B.
Okay. How do others vote?
So Erica, I vote for option B as well.
Okay.
I vote for option B as well.
Okay. Amy votes for option B. Megan?
I'm confused. Can you review those?
You bet. So we agree, like when we started the code, we were at 25 feet, which was unusual and specific to this building form. We decided that that wasn't something we wanted to have be different from the rest of the city. So we moved up to allowing the height at 28 feet. And so that matches the rest of the city. Yep. So in both option A and B, we're at 28 feet tall. But we have a choice of whether to use the existing methodology for height calculation that's in the existing code or adopt a new diagram, section K, that is proposed. And section K is reimagined, you know, the way that we do the measurement is reimagined to take away some of the things that have happened where people are measuring from the existing site, and we've ended up with 38 feet tall buildings, homes.
So I guess the comment I'll have is if we go to K, we're going to have to dig into, you know, there's a bunch of components to K. There's how do you find the average grade, and then how do you measure for a bunch of different diagrams? We have to look at ridge height. We have to look at parapets. We have to look at eaves. We have to look at all these min-max dimensions for every type of roof configuration. It just is like, it seems like a lot of brain damage to me that I'm not ready to, I haven't thought about right now. And if we're going to go this route, we have to put brain power to it. And I just figure, why wouldn't we do this with some background from other municipalities of best practices of how this works? Because I don't know that I've seen these particular diagrams in any other municipalities.
I guess my opinion is pointing to the regular city height, building height, and one day we will modify that, but with the overall idea of this document to better enable the developers to get middle housing done, I'm in a more, I would just like it to be less confusing. So I don't know what that option is. Is that A? Mm-hmm. I have no idea.
Well, A is not make a special case. Just follow
right. The city. Right. I would prefer not a special case.
Mm-hmm. So in that situation, I just want to make sure I understand things as well. In that situation, we have the potential for a taller building because it's all based on how we measure this, right?
Yeah, so on what you have in front of you, this is the methodology for the existing code.
Hang on, you're not sharing anything if you're trying to share something. We just see the PDF.
I think we're on page
13. There's the existing,
13.
Yeah, this is from the existing code. Now inserted into
gotcha.
When you end up with a slope site that has a grade change more than 10 feet, which in Hood River is not uncommon, we end up with the scenario where we measure 10 feet from grade to the highest point of the building, or 10 feet from lowest grade to the highest point of the building, which essentially can be a 38-foot elevation, a three-story elevation. And that is, it's just what it is. It results in a three-story or more building. So, and that's been a challenge in some of the infill sites when it comes to third-story living. If we're going to end up with no lot frontages, no lot coverages, it can be tricky. It's going to result in some significant, my concern is it's going to result in some significant set asides for fire department that's going to eat up usable area, and it's going to result in just larger buildings. Scale, it ends up being a more intense scale than the prescribed post-development grade, average grade look, and difference in building heights or building height calculations for pitched roofs, flat roofs, mm-hmm. shed roofs. It's more complicated. I wouldn't say it's more complicated, it's different. Administrative code, there's plenty of complications on what is pre-development grade and what is the highest point, so.
Amy?
Yeah, so I'm assuming you guys have talked to builders or where did you take that calculation from? Or where did you get that from?
Which calculation, which one?
Just the section K one of taking the average and then doing 28 feet from there. Did that come from a different city? Is that come from stakeholder groups? Where did that come from?
So the existing one is more similar to both Seattle and Portland's average grade. If you look, they'll shoot the corners of an existing, of a proposed building. So it's more reminiscent of that, that philosophy rather than 10 feet from the bottom. The change, the 28 feet, and I think that was item B, came from our local building community who stated that if we stuck to 25, it would be difficult to fully utilize the second floor. So that's where some of that commentary came from. The idea of the philosophy is to shorten the building to a two-story building. But they said if you went 25, not 28, the use of the second story would be compromised. So if that makes sense. So a little bit from everywhere.
Do you want to, for me, my challenge with this is I don't really want to put the brain power into actually dealing with this. And I feel like we need to deal with it because I start looking at your section K and I start looking at, oh, a parapet. Well, what is this going to be? How tall is this going to be? We haven't got comments from the building community. We rev this and we're going to 28 feet, but what does that mean for roof pitch? What does that mean for max eave height? And then we got to circulate that through the building community again and say, okay, guys, we just added 3 feet. Where do we add it? So that's why I'm punting. I think I'm happy to have the conversation, but then I'm going to want to go into the weeds on it. It's my problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So for those of you who want to suggest that we do B, let's do it and go into the weeds. And let's see some examples from different cities and let's do this, that, and the other thing.
So if we went with A and kept it the way that it is, I think the priority would be is to squeeze this into a near-term hearing. How long is it going to take to get missing middle through discussion once we're done with this document, right? We got to tee it up, take it through the city council. We could jump on the building height separately.
So maybe we should go look at K for a quick second. I mean, the average building height comment seems pretty straightforward. Add up four corners, divide by four, final grade. Mm-hmm. Like that's not complicated to me.
Right.
It's all the other stuff that's, and I think some cities actually base your building height depending on if you're on the uphill or downhill side of a street, some things like that. I think that we would evolve our conversation maybe when we really dug into it. In the meantime, if we want to just do something, we do this average grade in 28 feet. The place where I'm getting a little off track is the three pictures, pitched, shed, flat. Mm-hmm.
Page 15.
Do you want me to navigate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Page 13 and then 15. Yeah.
Yeah.
So page 14, take four corners, add them up, take the average. That sounds good so far. Building height calculation with a pitch roof, 25 max building height to the ridge height from this average grade.
So there's the difference between a pitch and a shed.
Mm-hmm.
The shed steps down even further.
So basically what we're saying is we're okay with the notion of 18 feet to a gutter line, to an eave. 18 foot to an eave, and then we transfer that down to the pitch roof, and we say if you don't want to go up with the roof, you don't need to, you can't take that eave any higher. Because what we're trying to do is get to a two-story building, not a three.
And then mentioning, now this is flat roof.
Can I ask, what is the issue with three-story buildings and flat roofs?
For one purpose on the fire side, if you're going to end up with a three-story building, we're going to end up with a 26-foot wide access road. Or access drive, so that they can, it's referred to as an aerial apparatus drive. If we're looking at smaller infill sites, that just erodes the site. That's one issue. The second is when you have a flat roof building and you build to the setback, there's really no pitch, so you end up with a greater mass of the structure within that distance of the house, rather than a pitched roof that steps back. That's where the benefit of the calculation and benefit goes to a pitched roof house rather than a roof house. So if you're against an elevation that is flat with a flat roof and it's at the same height, it essentially becomes a more mass with some mass.
There are concepts about averaging roof pitch, right? Yes. Dustin, you seen that?
Concepts about averaging
roof height?
Well, we have Terra. Well, not in our code, but
in some codes, have you seen an average root height where there's a peak and a, you know, a low and a high, and a you pick the middle?
Oh, you mean midpoint on a pitched roof?
Oh.
Midpoint on a pitched roof or average roof height, whether it's shed or gable or flat or.
Oh, yeah. There's, I'm sure we could come up with any different methodology we saw fit. So
have you seen that one before? Have you seen one like that?
I think most customary would be your midway pitch in the roof. That especially on a pitched roof site, rather than measuring to the ridge, you measure mid pitch. That becomes, well, we don't do that, and that's why we see flat roofs. I mean, that's the simple answer to that. So measuring mid pitch is very available. It's out there. It's just not the one that came because it can be a little trickier depending on what the pitch is. Highest point is pretty clear. It's a little more rigid, but it's more predictable.
So it seems to me that that kind of thing would just encourage flat roofs without the pitch, right? The average is the full height.
If say the average was something like 25 feet, you would have a flat roof at 25, or you could have an average slope that varies between 22 and 28 or whatever the numbers are, right? So that this is why I think we need to have the building height conversation, and we're half having it. We're not
prepared. Yeah, right.
That's why I was in the punt category.
Common are flat roofs around here. I know where I grew up in Arizona, and flat roofs are everywhere. And typically, you don't usually have flat roofs where there's lots of snow. Is that incorrect? Have I just not noticed that there are quite a bit of flat roofs around here?
There's flat roofs, and they will be designed to hold the snow. So there's not really any reason from a environmental safety structural problem. It'll just be designed to handle it. It's more the visual wall of
structure.
What this would look next to you, like that project we looked at on Oak Street, right, where you have houses on two sides with pitch roofs, and then you have something that's built up to the height limit of 28 feet all the way to the lot lines. It ends up with a real imposing view. Okay. Well, I think it seems that the consensus here is to leave the measurement at 28 feet, leave the measurement, the methodology as is today. But let's look for a way to have this deeper conversation as soon as we can.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay, so I guess when I craft up a recommendation, it'll be something along the lines of commission decided to stay with the existing building height with asterisk of please come back and revise everything.
To do with building height.
Yeah, to do with building height.
Not everything.
My comment would be overhauling all of our code is a major project. This is, in my opinion, tactical. I'd love to go to council and say, we're going to have to do it. You know, instead of having a hearing with 25 things on it, why don't we do the hearing for this one? Get it out of the way because we know we need to do it.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
We did half of page 2-3.
All right, good. At this rate, we'll be done tomorrow. No, it's an important one. So this page will stay as is with the existing building height reference.
I have one other comment that, and unfortunately some of my comments are, the big ones that come in the beginning. I had understood at our last meeting that we were going to maybe try and just delete the cottage cluster concept. And I saw it in here, and I'm trying to get my brain around. I understand that it's in there for some structural purpose, but I don't know that it's confusing. And I'm wondering if we actually need it. So could you, the reason I understand that you have it in here, Dustin, is for anything that is more than four units, that only single thing that it does is it moves their unit size down to 900 square feet. That's the only thing it does. Is that correct?
It's only the footprint. It's only the footprint that's 900, not the overall building size. It's the idea of differentiating the so before we had two units configuration, and then we had four, which is where the cottage lived. Anything more than four was going to be a cottage development. When you introduced the quad, it introduced a new building type where we could have four units in one building. So it differentiates four units on a single site as a cottage. It doesn't limit, it only limits the footprint of each individual building to 900, not the overall size.
So let me ask another question, which is if you did a two-story cottage that had a footprint of 900 square feet, would there be a floor area ratio maximum on it? Meaning a maximum square footage.
Yes. All the units get capped at 1,200 attached garage and 1,500 with an attached garage.
Okay. So really the only thing that that's doing here is capping the footprint. I don't know if we need it in here to do that because we already have that other limit. Did you put brain power to that?
Yeah, it's just differentiating the product types. So is it a single family home? And what differentiates a cottage from a single family home? It helps differentiate the two. It's just a small house. But it's a small house that can fall into this code set and be allowed some of the benefits or the sidebars that come under this, such as no minimum lot size, no frontage requirement, expert land divisions. So it helps differentiate the two.
So if we did four units, the units can be up to 1,200 square feet. If we did five units, then they have to be 900 or less footprint, six units, 900 or less footprint, seven units, 900 or less footprint.
Up to, if they're single family detached structures, over four of them. So if you end up with more than four single family detached structures, they have that cottage footprint.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sorry, I think that probably goes back to this page higher. I'm sorry, I wouldn't.
I understand the concept, and I'm trying to figure out what would happen if we just deleted it and fell back to the 1200 requirement that we have for everything else. Because theoretically, this could even be bigger if you wanted it, because it could be, or I guess it couldn't be. It's going to force your, it almost forces your cottages to possibly be two stories, which seems weird. Does that make sense? If we're limiting cottages to 900 square foot footprint and you want to do a 1,000 square foot cottage, you just made a two-story cottage.
So if you have two of them, they can be the main size. If you have three of them, they can be the main size. It's just once you get over four in a development, that's the trigger.
Right. So I'll go back to my comment. It seems, I don't know that it's intuitive to me that if you are increasing the units that we necessarily are, I think there's going to be a lot of other constraints to deal with to determine configuration. Is just the fact that we went from 4 to 5 mean that we have to drive these things into 2 stories possibly?
Yeah, I guess that's an option, or a story and a half. I guess that was the intent, though, is to allow that. They allow the story and a half to 2-story.
I've been asking a lot of questions. Anyone else have questions?
Yeah.
Sorry. Comments?
I guess my comment is that, you know, the cottage cluster is an idea, is out there. And if we could do something that allows people to build a cottage cluster that is smaller, then I'd like that. Whether you can achieve it without calling it a cottage cluster. So basically we're capped at 4 units. Is that, if I go to the maximum building chart.
So where this actually is probably most impactful is in the R1 zone, where you have 2 units attached is the maximum. If you mm-hmm. want to do a cottage cluster development in the R1, you can end up with 6 dwelling units. These are the sidebars that go on them. So it's probably, it still has a place in, especially in R1.
The concept that it seems kind of at odds to me is that we're calculating floor area or total square footage in half the discussion, and then we're talking footprint in the other half the discussion. If we want to define something as a cottage, which is less than 800 or 900 square feet, then we define that as a concept, and then we use that concept in things like the max unit area ratio thing that says if it's a cottage, then you get a bonus density. It just seems confusing the way it is. Because we do have a concept of something that's less than 800 square feet getting a bonus density, right?
That was in the side-by-side for once we get down to it, that if it was less than 100, it would be measured at a different density. But that was before FA floor area ratio came into discussion. Using the area of the real estate to set the number of dwelling units that could be permitted on any individual lot.
So I remember when this first came out, the cottage cluster concept was to encourage, it had open space, and we kind of got rid of that. It also, I thought, had a maximum of 1.5 floors. It wasn't going to be 2-story. And that there's a possibility of calculating an average footprint for the whole development, as opposed to per unit. So you could have an average of 1,000 for the whole thing. So some could be 1,200, some could be 800. So all that kind of went away as we talked through this. So now what we have left in this cottage cluster configuration is like, it's defined by a footprint. And I hadn't really thought about what Bill just talked about. This is encouraging 2-story cottages because it's, not that it has to be that, but it probably would encourage that. So it is hard to see the benefit of having this in there.
Yeah, I mean, it can be struck. In the R1, it's going to be the one area where it starts to take hold, is where in the R1 you have no more than 2 dwelling units other than the cottage. So you're you're not going to be, we didn't have a fourplex that was going to be allowed in R1. So now once you're getting into these smaller units, you don't really have a code that addresses if you wanted to do a series or a number of smaller, more than 2 smaller dwellings, unless you wanted to do multiple, what did you say?
Well, you can do a PUD. Right.
Or and PUD. Or without going to the right. PUD. Yep.
Right. So we could do that for that
situation. Well, it's a, you know, Greg Kraft's letter, because I hadn't really thought about that as much either, the idea that a lot of R1 zones will be 7,000 as opposed to 5,000, because I was picturing this in like in the 5,000 square foot lot. But when you get to 7,000 square feet, you do want to put in more units where you can. Because he was saying at least have another ADU allowed or something. We don't want this limit of two. So I know in the minutes I voted as saying let's have a limit of two units per R1 zone, but I'm wondering if that's what I want anymore, because I didn't think about these bigger lots. I thought I was thinking 5,000 square foot, and so the other option is to kind of get rid of that minimum for the R1, or increase it, or allow two units and an ADU or something.
Could I throw something out there, Dustin, and you shoot it full of holes? What would happen if we defined a cottage right here instead of a cottage cluster, and we define a cottage as something less than some particular square footage, and then we use that concept over in the other thing?
What do you mean the other thing?
In his table, which is what's allowed.
The max units, yeah.
Is that
so? And you're thinking a 900 or 1,000 square feet, but that would be total FAR, upstairs and down, that type of thing?
Yes, that's what I was thinking.
So it'd be a story and a half or something like that.
So
I mean, go ahead.
So we could define a cottage as, you know, for example, a single family detached unit of no more than X. You could put 1,200, I mean, you could use the same floor areas for the rest of them. With a, you know, floor area no more than 1,200 without a garage, no more than 15 with a detached garage, or with an attached garage, excuse me.
That feels so big.
Yeah.
You're trying to fit five or six of these onto an R1 lot. That feels unbelievably huge. That doesn't feel like what a cottage cluster is trying to be. You know, most cottage clusters are like 1,000 feet total for the building, if that.
Why can't it be scalable based on the square footage of the lot?
Well, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I think we had it scaled to the number of dwelling units based on the size of the lot, not based on the size of the cottage to the lot. So meaning a bigger lot could have more dwellings on it, not having a larger lot resulted in a larger, something falls under cottage, and then it becomes two full-size houses on one lot rather than two cottages on a
lot. Right. And I'm sorry, but where is that table?
Oh, that's going to be...
Page 7?
Yeah.
So, Dustin, do you think that what I propose is reasonable if we just figure out the right number?
Yeah, it probably requires some qualifier on within the code. I mean, if that's the definition, yeah, I would still need to have some sidebars on how does the cottage look. And I guess I'm trying to think that out. I mean, that...
I'm looking at Portland's code. I don't know if it's code or just something, but it says small, single-level, detached unit, often on their own lots and sometimes clustered around a pocket or shared open space. Cottage is typically under 1,000 square feet in footprint. I mean, for me... I like the idea of a cottage cluster as a one-story or a one-and-a-half-story, 1,000-square-foot something, and that if you do that, you can get away with some density or some density bonus or something like that. That feels good to me, but to just use a floor area ratio or a lot coverage ratio and allow four or five 1500 square foot homes to be built on a, you know, an R1 or an R2, that feels like we're headed in the wrong direction in my mind.
I agree with what you're saying, Mark. I'm just trying to figure out how to make this reflect that.
Yeah.
That's why I was going back to the, maybe this should be floor area and we should pick one and just define that as a cottage.
Okay. So maybe
pick 1,000. I mean, I don't know what the number is, but
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if you send a floor area, we have a definition of what floor area is right there. It would, you know, I guess an over under would, I could refine this as rather than configuration A.
I guess I'm suggesting adding this idea that it's a single level, although I don't mind so much if it's 1.5 story, it has a loft or something like that. So maybe we could look at how Portland has defined a cottage.
Do we have some traction to just change this to floor area and pick the number 1,000 and see what happens and move on to the next thing?
So take out footprint and put in floor area?
And pick, yes, and pick 1,000.
I like that.
And we could just delete the means of grouping of no fewer than. We could just define cottage as something that is that.
Mm-hmm.
And we use cottage down in the chart below, where if you're building a cottage, then you get this many cottages per something. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And 1,000 as opposed to 900?
Yeah.
Why?
Because that's what Portland says. Because it feels like we're going from a footprint of 900 to a full building at 1,000, full home at 1,000.
The footprint would allow for two stories.
Two stories that, yes, and they could be up to 1,200 or 1,500 square feet if there is a garage.
Yeah, which to me doesn't feel like a cottage. And so we're talking about creating a special building type called a cottage that acknowledges that it's small, 1,000 square feet. And then...
And that's the maximum or the minimum?
That's the maximum.
Oh, okay. I would have said 900 or lower.
Yeah, no, it's... So we're saying...
Yep. I know some two-story, 800 square foot, you know, skinny two-story cottage clusters in Bend that are, it's a great grouping. Mm-hmm. And they've managed to fit in like four or five of those on a lot. And it's great in terms of livability, having a two-story building that's a small square footage because it feels bigger.
Yeah. Well.
Mm.
Yeah, if you went to floor area, it just gives you flexibility whether you wanted to do one story, two story. It just caps the unit size, whether regardless of its footprint.
Right. Yeah, I'm a favor of that. Mm-hmm.
Which is also why you'd want it a little bit bigger than the 900, I think. It's capped at 1,000. Okay.
Well, if Portland has figured out a way to describe a 1,000 square foot cottage, that let's take a look at that and not make Hood River different.
So do you have four of you who agree to floor area, not less or no more than 1,000?
I agree with that.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. So I think we're good on that.
We'll all take right. my note taker. Will hopefully track that one.
Okay.
I had one thing on the, this is in the weeds and hopefully not a big discussion item, but floor area, I had a concern with the last sentence. It says a basement or attic space that is occupiable regardless of finish with a ceiling height of more than 6'8". So the regardless of finish is throwing me off a little bit, and occupiable. So certainly in some attics, there's an area where you're outside of the building envelope in the eve, you know, in the pitch of a peak of a roof, and it's over 6'8". So the regardless of finish part's throwing me off a little.
I took that straight from the building code when they calculate the number of stories. This would be either an attic that has a height over 6'8", or a basement that is unfinished still counts to floor area. So you can't just have a unfinished space that all of a sudden is exempt. They count it as a story.
Occupiable, does that necessarily mean that it's heated?
No.
Okay. So have we defined occupiable?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it would be an occupiable space. If it's less than 6'8", it can't be occupiable.
Well, what happens if my attic has like a pull down ladder in it and it's 6'8" above it? I'm just trying to figure out, it's unfinished. It's not heated. We're going to deter, or I got a crawl space that it's on a slope lot that's taller than 6'8" in one area of my crawl space. So that's where I'm a little hung up. I want to make sure we're clear on what we're counting.
Yeah, if it's over 6'8" in the attic, we'd count it. If there's a basement that's over 6'8", we would count that as well.
With a pull down ladder from the ceiling.
But I can imagine, I'm thinking of a house I just saw recently where because of the slope, there's quite a bit of headroom in the crawl space. But it's not finished and it's not occupiable because there's no insulation to the exterior wall underneath the main finished floor, right? So this, I guess, is trying to prevent somebody building it that way, and then the moment it is built, they finish out the basement, finish out the attic, and they end up with a lot more square footage. That's how I read what this is trying to prevent.
Well, I mean, how do we not just start measuring useless areas in the peaks of attics and live on a hill? I'm just trying to make sure that we're not going to be counting space that is never going to be used.
Yeah, this seems a little.
Can we say like that it's inside the building envelope or something, right?
Well, it's all going to be inside the building envelope, I believe.
Well, I guess.
It's inside the building, but it's.
Yeah.
It's not heated.
Yeah. Yeah. The insulation and the heat is, it's either sealed or it's vented to the outdoors in a crawl space or an attic, right? There's a difference.
Yeah. I think the issue becomes how easy and how quick that can be converted. I mean, a scissor truss or a prefab truss that allows an attic, it just differentiates. It's then no longer an attic. Then it's a story. I guess that's also part of it. And that's from the building code too. And same with the basement. Once it's bigger than a certain area, it's no longer a basement. It's floor area. It's a story. Clarifying it or parsing it may be portions of the basement or attic with the ceiling height over that would be narrowing it. So if you have a pitched roof, only the portions over 6'8" count.
Yeah, it just seems like we're going to get a lot of flat roofs because people don't want to be counting pitched roof areas. It seems like this is headed in the wrong direction.
That's what I'm thinking. Can we just clarify this, that it's unheated or something?
Yeah, let me and I think we had climate controlled before. Occupiable space, I think, inferred climate controlled area. Yeah,
sure. That makes sense. If someone's got a inside their building envelope, they just didn't, paint it or sheetrock it or something like that, but it's got heating and cooling and this, we should be counting it.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you there's houses in Severcrop that don't have stairs to a full finished floor height finished basement that don't have studs and roughed in, that very well, can constitute another 600 to 800 square feet when finished. So being able to differentiate that clearly, and think for the sake of fairness, that is, we want to make sure that we're clear in the code on what is in and what is out.
Okay, so I think we want to expand on the word occupiable to include something to do with heated conditioned space or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Controlled and occupiable, yeah. Okay.
All right, are we done? Anything else on page 3 there, Bill? Anyone else?
I'm good.
There was a request to add the definition of landscape. So this is a custom definition. I think the key area is, where do we measure it from the property lines in? And it's what is excluded from that? Your building is not landscape. Structures, parking, walkways, and decorative pavement are taken out. That's not landscape. And then a request for middle housing code, or what is middle housing, is now included. Differentiating full size duplex and a quad, essentially, we're talking about a middle housing code. This is the sidebars. So differentiating similar configurations. The idea of a cottage is a small house. It's not a full house. So helping to expand on that idea.
So we would probably just modify this to delete cluster and just put cottage in this list, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Okay.
Nothing changed on this page other than I included definitions for mulch and non-living ground cover. We can talk about that when we get the landscape. This section includes that, including the term xeriscape, which is not a unique definition, but clearly something we need to differentiate between xeriscape, which is a water-wise landscaping philosophy. Xeriscape is gravel and rock mulch. They are not the same. So that is included in definitions. Really didn't have a whole lot from this section over the past 4 meetings.
Could we stop at E1 when you get there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my next stop. Planning Commission had asked for an amendment to this, including we had homeowners association. The addition is other common ownership agreement that will provide. So providing an opportunity to not require an HOA, but putting in the provision for another ownership agreement, generic term.
Could I recommend that we, because in a lot of these configurations, there's nothing that would actually be owned in common. I'd like to change the word common ownership agreement to common maintenance agreement.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Okay. That's an easy enough change. If that represents everyone's interest.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Sounds good. The only thing, I mean, I like what number 1 says there, but the covenants, conditions, and restrictions, is it okay that we continue to use that language even if there is no HOA? Do you think covenants and restrictions is the way that they would write up a common maintenance agreement, using those terms?
I think it's pretty generic. I mean, I think that that kind of covers anything that has a restriction or covenant.
Yeah. You know,
by binding or informal. I think that's just the catch-all in term of art. I don't think it necessarily, if it's not entitled CC&Rs, it defeats the purpose of the definition.
It seems reasonable to me that a common wall agreement or a common maintenance agreement would fall under that set of terms.
Okay. All right. Good deal.
Question. So sorry, go back up to number two. Would it make sense, since we are talking about changing things to floor area, would it also make sense to refer to the total square foot area as floor area? Or is that, are we talking about different things?
Oh, I think when we were talking about the floor area, I think we were initially talking about the total development. I think this one's referring to notice of an to an individual owner that they may not be allowed to increase the size of their dwelling. Individual, so individual future notice.
Okay.
You buy a 1,000 square foot cottage, that is what you buy, and that's how it stays.
Okay.
Getting into the grittier details, the chart has been updated, and I think I can zoom in. This was actually cut off from the last time. It talks about the maximum number of dwellings within the with each individual dwelling site per building. So it used to be 2 and 3. Now it adds 4 units in all the zones per building, with the exception of R1. So two units per building within R1. Yeah. And 4 in the other 2 or 3 zones.
I had 2 comments that were maybe general, and I wasn't quite sure where to bring them up. And they were related to some of Greg Kraft's comments about the 4,500 versus 4,500 house with an ADU and 2,500 square foot separate dwelling. But then I also was trying to remember or have an opinion on, are we talking about average size or maximum for these different things? And do we get into the configuration where maybe I've got a 1800 square foot house with an ADU in the basement and a ADU or a 400 square foot unit in my basement and a 400 square foot unit in my garage? So maybe we should start with, for these size limits, are they a maximum per unit, or is there some averaging happening here?
I think it's number of dwellings in a building, in a single building.
Got it. But there's some spot, maybe it's further down, where we do the limitation stuff. Where's the 1,500?
Oh yeah, that's actually maximum unit to area. That's in this chart as well.
That's per development, you mean? Line right above? Okay.
Yep. There's both, right above is units per development as well as units per area. That's all in this chart.
Where's the 1,200 maximum and then 1,500 with an attached garage section?
Oh, that'll be in building size. That would be further down.
Okay, well, maybe that's where I need to bring up my second comment.
this sticks with the 4 units included. So the 4 unit or the quad.
Yeah.
Is now in.
Question on that. In regards to Heather Staton's email with the fourplex, it seems like we're still not getting to what she's recommending. What am I missing?
Yeah, I don't know.
All right, I'll look up her comment letter and then see if I can better understand.
Yeah, the code now includes a quad.
Is it only included if it's part of an existing renovation of an existing facility, or is it allowed standalone now?
Yeah, this would be standalone. The renovation of the existing facility is handled at the end separately.
Okay.
Based on previous conversation, I'd also make a note that the cottage cluster configuration I'll take a look at that and make sure that's reconciled.
Okay.
No changes in this section per our discussion. Lot coverage still remains. Frontage still remains as presented. Parking, this is a commission recommendation to go to 0.75. I had to put in a rounding add on here because only when we get to divisions of four will we end up with even numbers. So we had to figure out all the other configurations.
What happens if you have one of those little cars they have in Japan?
Still full car.
I'm just kidding.
You get a scooter bonus.
You do bring up a good point that if people have two smart cars, they should be able to fit them in the same space as one gigantic truck.
We're not telling people how to buy a car. And one thing about our code is we don't discriminate between tandem parking and non-tandem parking. Actually, in our codes, they won't count tandem parking. Our code set from top to bottom does allow that. So if you ended up with a tandem scenario, you don't get credits for two spaces, but our tandems count full freight.
Mm-hmm. And then I had a question on downtown. Is there anywhere in downtown that would benefit from this middle housing code?
C1. There's some C1 spaces downtown. So that would be, that's why it's included. So at the periphery of the downtown central business district, there's some C1 spaces. And that's why it got included in the code.
Okay. And we don't have any appetite on the commission to excuse downtown from a parking minimum like Ashland and to make a minimum exception for downtown.
I'll ask a question. I don't know if I have an answer for you, but another question. Will we still have defined business districts, Heights and downtown?
Yep.
Yes.
And so they would be eligible for fee in lieu.
Okay. So in the fee in lieu for residential, is it still 18,000 or some large number? 20,000?
3,000.
Okay.
3,000 as it is now.
So to be the contrarian to Megan's, or to support Megan a little bit, if we're in one of those zones and they don't want to provide parking, they can just pay $3,000 for the space. Is that a correct statement?
That's a correct statement.
Yeah, but that defeats affordable and or attainable housing. That automatically increases the price tag of the development. I'm just looking at the Strong Towns map and Ashland, Eugene, and I know we have some objections to using examples that don't exactly match what Hood River is, even though I would say that every single town is unique. But in terms of the Pacific Northwest, Colville, Washington, which I've never heard of, is very small. Pasco, Washington. Yakima, these all have places that have zero parking requirements in their downtown area.
Yeah, downtown will on multifamily will be 1.25 spaces based on the downtown parking study. So this already has a benefit over that. And if the fee in lieu is also
The fee in lieu is a lot less than it used to be. Yeah. So those two changes by itself make it easier.
Yeah, we went from $20,000 last year to $3,000.
Mm-hmm.
So it's significant reduction. Whether that stays that way, that's what it is now. So.
Yeah, I would suggest keeping it where it is. I think there should be some accommodation or notification. I think that will be a burden on the city. So I think we've already reduced the number down to 0.75.
I'm in support of leaving it at 0.75 and they can pay for the in lieu. I mean, I think if you're only building two spaces, $6,000 is not going to, or whatever the number is, not going to make or break a project.
Yeah.
I did want to hit on number three, which I thought we had, we went back and forth on this discussion about we want to avoid the everything mm-hmm. driveway on the front of the place, but also we didn't necessarily want to be having to drive around to the back of everything and eat up permeability and green area. So I thought we had made the decision down in the infill or the redevelopment, but also in this section to allow 50% in the front yard setback.
Yeah, the change is only made to the, I think it came up for existing space that's already permitted for conversion of a house. So that's the only space where I changed it was for existing home to be converted could allow the configuration as it is. And using the current code, it's one space can be allowed in the front yard. So that's where the language from the current code shows up in the conversion section.
Right.
I didn't touch anything here.
I had understood we had discussed changing it in both places, but maybe we should revisit that conversation because I might have been incorrect.
And so the argument for leaving it out of this location was this idea that we wanted to pull the houses towards the front of the lot onto and be engaged with the street as opposed to the houses hiding behind the cars, right, Dustin? That was the...
Yeah.
So we grandfathered in parking if it was an existing place, but if it was a new place, we wanted to do it right and, quote, do it right. But as Bill says, you end up with driveways and a lot more driveway to get to the back.
Which we're looking at the diagram right below on the top, and you're like, mm-hmm. where's the yard? Because you just parked all the cars in the back.
Okay, so how about we do an A or B on this one? Mm-hmm. So those in favor of allowing half of the parking. Is it half of the parking or one spot? What did we say?
Current code allows one.
One spot in the front.
Which for a single dwelling unit is one out of two. I think that's where, but it specifically says one.
I thought it said 50%. No?
No, it says one.
Okay.
All right.
So how would, I'm trying to think,
How does it work with 0.75 per unit?
That's what I'm wondering. If we got six cottages and we got three spots or four spots, if I'm doing my math right, what do we want to see? What's reasonable? None? In the setback? Some in the setback? Not all four in the setback. I think we can all agree with that.
I'm fine with some in the setback as long as it's in the back with alleyway access.
I was talking about front yard setback. So
frontage, yeah.
Does everybody want none in the front yard setback?
Yes.
I think 50% of the total. So in your example, Bill, if it was four total parking spaces, two could be in the front.
Yeah, that seems like a good compromise.
For the A or the B, I would be the vote. If A is none in the front yard setback and then B is up to 50% in the front yard setback, I would be a vote for B.
Yeah, I think I'm a bit worried about six or eight cottages and all of a sudden we are, you know, we're back to four houses across the front or something, four cars across the front of the lot. It feels like we didn't end up with the city that we wanted, I think is my issue.
Oh, sorry.
Amy?
So if you did put, so I guess going back to that, I guess I'm having a hard time visualizing that in my head as to what it would look like if you put 50% in the front. Would that mean that you'd have to create more driveways?
Yeah, I mean, that would, you would need 20, at least 20 feet wide if you were to do, if you had four, say you required four spaces for your development. Two of them end up in the front yard. That's a 20-foot wide driveway.
I think that's what would concern me, just because, at least from what I remember previous discussions, that's what we were trying to get away from.
Is there a model where people have parallel parking in the front?
Some of our diagrams had like some parking down, like cars were parked parallel to the frontage up the side, and in that case I think possibly using the first space in the front yard setback makes sense to me, and that's kind of the point of, I think, what I'm trying to have this conversation.
Dustin?
Yeah, I don't think any, I definitely didn't put anything in the front yard. That was pretty, especially when it came to, you know, the building perimeter, the site perimeter, not the internal part. That was less of an issue. It was really more of holding the front yard for landscape space. Because now, remember, we're only landscaping the setbacks. We're not doing site coverage. That's the area landscape. So that's part of it. And
okay,
there's subsequent code in here that prohibits the cars from being parked between the building and the public right of way as well. So if we move down, we'll see that code appear again.
Well, it seems like if we got an example of a corner lot, or we have an example of an alley, those are both public right-of-ways, and at some point you're going to park cars between buildings and those.
Yeah, there's an alley exception in this.
What about a corner lot exception?
The parking doesn't come between the building and the right-of-way in the perimeter setback. There's an exception to allow the driveway to go occur through it, but not the parking spaces themselves.
So I think Greg Kraft's letter indicated that if you required all parking to be in the back, that it limited the options in terms of the configurations you could put on a lot. So my intention with allowing some in the frontage is just to enhance flexibility of configuration and encourage more units to fit on.
Yeah, I think I'm torn in that, you know, I like the idea of what we're trying to do in terms of a livable, walkable neighborhood with engagement. I'm torn with that. And then I'm torn with the idea that, you know, this is another unique circumstance. This one type of building type doesn't play with the rules as everybody else. I think the argument which led us to the first thing was to say that because, in looking at figure one there, figure ones and twos, because you're ending up with more dwellings, if you end up parking in the front, you are doing more curb cuts. And what we were trying to also do here is recognize that we've got more units on the site that could lead to lots of curb cuts, lots of driveways, lots of, you wouldn't be able to use the street to park on regularly. And, you just see a bunch of cars and driveways. And that's what we were trying to avoid. So I think I'm not that much in favor of parking on the front. I can see it in the existing situation because it's grandfathered in, but you know, from my perspective, we're trying to recognize that with so many units facing the street, we don't want these mini houses all having their own car in the front, because they could choose to do that, right? So Max, what are we saying here?
50%.
Maximum 50%. So seems like they're gonna have to create some mechanism of parking at the back anyway.
So when on streets like A, B, and C, for example, that will never, I don't know if they're ever intended to have sidewalks or if they will ever have sidewalks. What is the problem with letting a developer put in two parallel parked spots that are right next to the street? It accomplishes two things. One is it significantly reduces paving. Two, it gets the car off the street. And three things, it doesn't allow another car to park next to that. So the cars get off the street and they can't park on the street. If you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes the people, like I have family friends that don't want cars parked on the street because they want more, they want their children to be able to walk and bike on the street and not have to worry about parked cars obscuring vision.
I think you're talking perpendicular parking.
No, parallel.
Parallel to the frontage, yeah.
Yeah, like traditional parallel parking. It looks like a regular street, but it's been extended.
Yeah, the current code wouldn't allow parallel parking in the front yard adjacent to the street. A, B, and C would all be local street sections. So the intent would be they all would eventually have some sort of storm system, some sort of sidewalk system that went in place. So though they are not compliant now, they don't have a special street configuration. So the issue with if we got parallel in the front yard would be, it'd be essentially unlimited curb cut, no opportunity for sidewalk, no opportunity for street trees or storm sewer in those configurations.
The concept that I was kind of trying to push was perpendicular parking in the setback, whether it be front or side for a corner lot. I mean, imagine in like a six cottage cluster and you stick two off of one street and two off of the other, and those four serve your whole development and you're not infilling cars into the living space.
Yeah, I guess in that instance, when it was first introduced, that's our, now we've lost all our on-street parking. So now we have private parking that goes head in. We've chopped up the sidewalk. There's no street trees and there's no on-street parking for the public. That's the, we'll give nod to Arthur and his net zero minus proposition.
Well, two car, I mean, it's a two for one, right?
No. It's not just the matter of the width of the street. You also, we can't just give them 10 feet of exit. It also flares. So our driveways end up getting bigger than just the lane width itself.
Okay.
So what's the proposal here? Do we want to do a straw man again of straw person of who's looking to, is it one space max? Is it 50% of the parking requirement straight off the street? Or is it third option, no parking? Where is it written right now?
Nothing occurs on the setbacks.
Nothing occurs on the setbacks.
Nothing occurs between the building and the public right away. Mm-hmm. And this is all setbacks. So you can't park in the side yard. You can't park in the front yard. Mm-hmm. You can park except for an alley, which we expect probably some head in the alley configuration.
Okay. So three options, A, B, and C. A is one space. B is 50%. C is no parking and setbacks. How does everybody vote on that? One space, is this same as the existing building grandfathered in? 50%?
Yeah. That is, we could wait till the existing, that is, you know, that's handled separately.
It'll be discussed later, yes.
I guess the concept that I'm kind of thinking of, I'm trying to think of cottage communities, and I go over to Wires End and all the parking's like right there, and then you walk down this green and all the cottages are around it, and it seems like getting the parking closer to the street for me is better. And I understand the curb cut argument. We don't necessarily want to have an infinite curb cut. So I'm kind of wondering if we had some concept of 50%, but limit the curb cut.
Yep, I'm right there with you. Mm-hmm. The worst case scenario is 50% parking in front. You still create a really long driveway to get to the back, and you have two cars in back, and that's like the worst of both worlds. Like, I'd rather take up the curb so people can't park on the street and preserve the land for communal space or open space. So I think there should be an incentive to grouping the parking around the street or the alley.
Yeah, I feel more comfortable if it's an alley than the street.
So Megan, you're saying all of the parking should be that way then and not have any in the back. Is that right? Understand that right? All the parking should be encouraged, should be in front so that you can have an open.
Yes. I don't want a hybrid where you can have some front and 50, some 50. Back. Yeah. Because then that's more asphalt.
Right.
Okay, so I think I'm hearing Megan and Bill are talking about some way of allowing some portion of the parking be straight off the street, but and not deep into the lot, but somehow minimize the exposure on the main road. Anybody else want to go with that? Sue, are you with that notion?
I'm not clear. That's what I was trying to understand with from Megan, if she still wants to allow parking in the back. What is your proposal, Megan? Parking only on the setbacks, basically. Because you don't want to have it in both places, right? That's what you're saying, because then you've got more pavement in the back.
Right. Yeah, if you're gonna create a driveway, you might as well do it all on the back. If you're not to save the driveway,
right? Right.
Right. I don't know. I think
that's different than what you're saying, Bill.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what I'm saying. I mean, I was thinking like a couple of spaces of either head-in parking or parallel parking. With a limited, say, maximum, do we have a maximum curb in our code right now, or maximum curb cut, Dustin? Isn't it 20 feet or something?
Yeah, there's one below here, G1A on the same page. Your driveway approach not exceeding 14 feet. That's one lane, one passing lane.
That's for the entire development, no matter what size it is.
Right. So I would be at the let 50% be in the front yard setback or a maximum of 50%, the lesser of 50% or two spaces or something in the setback, the front yard setback, with the understanding that we're only going to have a curb cut of 14 feet.
But if the other 50% is in the front setback, that's additional curb cuts, right?
No. That wasn't exactly what I was imagining. I'm thinking of the case where you pull in and you maybe have a space or two and a hammerhead to turn around and pull back out, and it's your parking's clustered right there. And one of those spaces happens to be in your setback. You still have your sidewalk. You still have your planting strip.
Because
all that stuff doesn't happen in the setback, right? All that planting strip, sidewalk, right, and all the junk's in the right of way.
Right. So I would agree with that. If we could still have this, the curb cut requirement, then I would go with the, 50% parking allowed in the front.
Or maybe it's one space in the development or something. Because if you pull in and you're stacking your parking all in a row right there towards the front of the property, and you have green space and cottages along the side or the back or around it, maybe you take advantage of that first spot when you pull in the driveway, first spot in the setback, and then you stack it right up there.
I agree with Sue with the 50% and the limitations on curb cuts.
That's where I'm at.
There's just no perfect answer.
No. What about a maximum of 50% or two spaces? That way we don't have like four in a row in front, taking up the whole frontage.
Regardless of the number of units.
It's going to be a maximum of.
Yeah.
So with this 15, this two spaces, you'll end up with two spaces plus this 14 feet curb cut? Or is it either or, right?
You can use two spaces or a
14-foot curb cut.
No, you have to use the 14-foot driveway to get to your two spaces. That's okay. the way I read this.
Yeah.
Okay, I could get with that.
Is that your understanding?
Is
that your understanding of how that would be interpreted, Dustin, if we were to say that?
No.
No.
I think
you can't fit two spaces into 14 feet.
No, but I think Bill is referring to you have one curb cut allowed. It's maximum 14 feet. That would allow you to access two spaces in your front yard. Maximum two spaces in your front yard.
In the frontage of two units.
Or whatever your yard area was for your development. So it's 14 feet plus 20 on each side.
That's not what I was understanding. That's not what I was trying to say.
So I'm correct. I didn't understand.
What I was trying to say is that we stick with the concept of there's one entrance per street frontage, and it's a maximum of 14 feet wide. However, you're allowed to put some parking in your setback, your front yard setback.
Okay, so that curb cut would not go farther than 14 feet, but they can have flexibility where they put the parking spot. And it can be within that space. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. You couldn't park in the right of way, so you couldn't park in the middle of the sidewalk. But it could be in the front yard setback. And I'm just thinking of a little picture where you pull in and park stacked parallel to the frontage. I can draw you a little picture.
I think I'm drawing the picture here.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's see it. Or I was thinking of, I guess that would get there. I was thinking of some other picture.
Mark, your picture is what I was thinking, what I was picturing.
Well, I was also wondering whether it's a way to get to the back as well, but... okay, should we
here's my little quick
here we go.
So I'm envisioning that you have one driveway cut, and then maybe there's two spaces and a way to back out and turn around, and you've got a lot of room left for cottages and green space and stuff like that, versus having to drive these cars all the way to the back of the lot.
Yeah. So what you're doing is you're basically sacrificing some house frontage onto the street in that location, in that area. So you'd push the development to the back.
And the reason I'm advocating it is I think you'd have more green space overall.
Yeah, I think
and less paving.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you'd also have more flexibility if you can park in the front and the back, and you can split that somehow and still maintain a single curb cut. You've given the developer more flexibility in how they lay it all out.
Yes, you could take my little picture and put two in the front, and then use the same driveway and go to the back.
Or you could put all four in the back. Yeah.
So I guess my proposal would be that we leave the driveway approach to be 14 feet per frontage, and then maybe one space in the setback. Because I saw your little picture, which kind of splits them in at that point. You got two 18 feet deep spaces on either side of a 14-foot driveway, your entire yard, front yard, is part is cars.
Mm-hmm.
Mark's picture.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
You're just staring at cars. So maybe we just say we can only put one in the setback, and that would give them a little bit of flexibility to do something different.
I think the issue I'm seeing is just this idea that we're trying to engage the street, and by doing that, we're pushing the houses way back off the street. So Dustin, is there something that allows or disallows where the front of these residences are relative to the street or any other house type, townhouse?
Yeah, I mean, it
R2.
Everything now doesn't allow your garage setback everywhere is 20 feet, which is reflected in this code.
Mm-hmm.
Allows one space in the front yard. In the front yard. I mean, that's mm-hmm. current code is one space, one required space is allowed in the front yard. And the garage must be set back 20 feet. So it matches that allowance. This is definitely a very intentional code piece that pushes the house forward. I mean, it's very prescriptive. So when in by way of flexibility, it's not flexible. It's very predictable. And it is different. I mean, nope. It will definitely make things, it will not allow the parking in the front. I mean, that's pretty, so by way of flexibility, it's intentionally not flexible.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted a code that said no more than one space in the front yard, and this is all setbacks. So just so you know, this is considers inability to park in the side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and allowing one in the front setback would be pretty much going back to, it's pretty much what your current baseline code is, allowing one in the front.
Hmm.
But our current code allows a driveway width of 22 or 24 feet.
19.
Our current code, that's a max at 19?
Yep.
Okay.
Which is essentially accommodates two car driveway. I mean, that's your 19 feet.
Right. So where I was trying to get was one car. I'm trying to do less cars than we have now, but something. That's mm-hmm. where I was shooting for.
Less than one. So.
But I'm gonna make
more dwelling units too.
I'm gonna make I'll make the proposal and see A or B.
Okay.
If we stick with the 14 feet of maximum driveway approach, I would be a supporter of one of the requisite parking spaces could be in the front yard setback. That's
okay.
Or option B is there is no parking allowed in the front yard setback. I'm in A.
Even for a really large lot.
Yeah, we heard you.
Yeah, what's your, you think it should be 50%, Erica?
Well, I mean, that's why I preferred the 50%.
Yeah.
You know, some of these lots might get large, and to just have one spot in the front if you're looking at multiple units on a larger yacht.
Lot. Yeah, if you have 100 feet of frontage or something, I mean, it seems.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could be a supporter of 50, maybe it needs to be limited by the amount of frontage, because I didn't love Mark's picture of two cars parked in the front yard.
Yeah, tie it to frontage or lot size. Say one allowed unless, you know, you have 100 feet or more of street frontage.
Does the 14 feet per that we're looking at in G1A here, is that 14 feet per lot or the entire, like if there's four lots that are all built out at the same time, is it 14 feet for the entire development or is it per 50 foot wide?
Per project. So if you have, you driveways are scripted as one driveway per frontage for the entire development.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up with no, by way of the code, you're not going to end up with more than 12 units, even in your max for a single project. So that would be 12 units using one driveway.
Mm-hmm.
Intent of trying to make this compatible with an infill by way of design. Most homes don't have more than one driveway. So this is kind of taking some of the design cues from that. And again, a kind of that traditional neighborhood design of house first, house forward, mm-hmm. and street with your architecture. But that's why it's written none, so.
Which the traditional, you know, pre-car craftsman neighborhood design is in some cases different than what the modern cottage cluster layout is, because in a lot of cases that parking is clustered somewhere and in some cases it's right in the front and there's a bunch of green space behind it. So it's, we're at odds with two different concepts.
I think the cottage cluster went away. So,
well, but I think, you know, but okay. So it's the, we're at odds in that option. Option A is keep the cars next to the street. And option B is keep the backyard green, right? So it's basic as that, right? So I'm struggling with this choice. I like the idea of engaging the street with houses, not cars. What do you think, Dustin, about some magical formula that comes up with the length of the length of the street? How many 14 feet we can deal with?
Well, there's an access spacing requirement that's built in here. You know, a local street that's 22 feet between them. I'm trying to think about the idea of the development size not going to be particularly big. So if you end up with something more, I feel like we're starting to tread into PUD land.
Mm-hmm.
If you're, and remember this needs to be very clear and objective. So mm-hmm. One of the ENCODE intents is that we don't get into this discretionary, you know, so the mathematics are good when it comes to this.
How do we move on here?
Maybe we just need to have a vote.
Let me refine my proposal so that we have it out there. So, 50, the parking can be in the setback for the lesser of 50% of the requirement or 50% of the frontage or some other number, 30% of the frontage or whatever it is. So we don't get Mark's picture. Percent of the frontage. You got a 50 foot wide lot. You got a 50 foot wide lot. You got an 18 foot parking space. What's that division? <laughs> 36%. Got a 100 foot lot. Two cars. That would be my proposal for one of the, for my, I'm revising my option.
Mm-hmm.
Up to 50% of the parking, a maximum of 36% of the frontage. Which would be less than what we have today.
And you're saying this 50% can be in the setback?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Okay. That's option A, and option B is 14-foot curb cut parking out of the setback in the back of the back of the lot. All right. So we go for a vote on option A or B. I mean, I think option A, I think we need to probably look at some more test fits for how that might look, but conceptually to investigate it. Are people in favor of the idea of accommodating? Are you saying accommodating 2 or 50%? You're saying 50% of the vehicles in the setbacks.
50% of the parking requirement could be in the front yard setback, and it could not exceed parking out more than 36% of the frontage.
The frontage, yeah.
Okay. All in favor of that proposal?
I'll vote for that one, but I might be the only one. Okay.
Bill, it's not, not that I'm not in favor of it. I'm just having a really hard time with this parking issue. I can't believe how much time we're spending on this and not on the prior one, which would alleviate all of this.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to take a more libertarian approach of letting the developer do whatever they want to. And on a street that is not going to have a designated sidewalk anyway, who cares? Because people are going to be walking in the middle of the street anyway. So, and there's going to be way more street action on a narrow street that doesn't have sidewalks with people walking in the middle of it than there would be with a street that has sidewalks. And lots of parking. So it's like Tina said, this is a conundrum. We like love our cars, but we don't want to see them. I don't get it.
Yep. Other thoughts?
Well, I think the idea of putting cars in the front, there were two reasons for that in the frontage for me. One was the idea of a developer having flexibility, which Dustin kind of spoke to. It's like, that was not necessarily what we're after. We want something perhaps more prescribed. And I can see that. And then we also got rid of the requirement for open space. So we're not going to get put cars in the front, and it's not going to encourage any more open space in the back necessarily. So that's kind of pushing me more towards just put them all in the back and at least have, you know, the house front approach on the street side for aesthetics.
I mean, one of the things that I'm struggling with a little bit is that, you know, the reason we're going to the back is that we are getting to other development, other homes in the back of the lot. And it feels like if we put parking in the front, we'll end up pushing more buildings into the back, into what is typically backyard type space and away from the street. You're not engaging the street and you're filling up, you know, the back of the lot. So I'm struggling with that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm inclined to kind of stick with what we have here in terms of one curb cut at 14 feet and stay away from the parking on the front. which is B, option B. So how do you vote? So let's go through. We got one Bill in the A camp. We got one Mark in the B camp. How does everybody else feel?
Erica is in the A camp.
A. Get something close to the street. Megan? Amy?
I guess I'll opt for A since...
A?
Yeah.
Okay. And... Sue? Amy?
B. I'll go with B.
B as well.
All right, we've got a split vote. Dustin, it's up to you. The tie vote. You're the tie voter.
Why don't we just give both of those to council and they can we can have some comment on it.
Yep. Okay.
I'll take that as
moving
on.
I
can add that on there as split, kind of a split recommendation on this piece and requiring or allowing some parking in the front back.
Yeah.
Or front setback.
Okay. Well, how are we feeling? We are 2 hours in. What's left, Dustin?
We have FAR.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much it. That's it on my list.
Pretty much sounds like a trap.
Well, that is all I have other than the conversion, which we kind of touched on already.
Yeah.
The conversion, what do you mean?
The allowance.
Existing, yeah.
Yeah, we touched on it. There was a change in the end of the code that allowed the conversion of an existing single family dwelling up to 4 units.
Allowed
to remain in place.
Okay.
That was your.
Okay, yeah.
All right, so floor area ratio, we have a table around that. Do people feel we have energy to tackle floor area ratio discussion now? This is the hard one.
What page are we on for
like
this one?
9 or 10, or are we talking another half an hour?
What page are we, tell me what page we're on in the code.
It's not in the code. I provided you the residential infill project.
Got it. Yep.
And the philosophy, this would known as the 8-page recommendation from Portland.
Yes.
Okay. So what a Hood River version would look like as comparables, if you wanted to, I have that ready if you wanted to get into that.
Got it.
On your philosophy and how you
how
took
about this then? So I'm with Erica. I think we could knock this out by 8 o'clock.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. I don't know why it's going to take a while. So
yeah, so let's go with that. I am wondering about if anybody in the audience who's been patient wants to get a word in. Raise your hand. We're going to go. Why don't we go into looking at the height? I'm sorry, the floor area ratio piece.
Okay, let me.
And while we look at that, if anybody from the audience, Heather, Molly, Nancy, or Greg, want to interject, please raise your hand. We'll promote you so that you can speak. Dustin, you want to get us started here?
Let me know if you see a PDF of Portland infill.
I see Portland infill.
So this is what I sent over from the Portland infill project. This is in regards to the three zones that they picked for their infill project and the philosophy or the idea of starting with the base zone, then looking at taking a relook at your base zone and providing a floor area for a single family home, and then gradually allowing that to escalate in terms of number of units. So this is their philosophy. Much like Portland, our current allowed FAR is not really based on FAR. It's based on setback height and building coverage. So they're pretty apples to apples in terms of Hood River there. We look at building coverage. We take the height that essentially minus the allowed parking really kind of determines what our predictable, somewhat predictable FAR is. So I provided this to you. And again, I have a Hood River kind of estimated version of what kind of what it looks like with for us.
Did you send that out?
No, I just drafted for your discussion as you, I sent this out. I didn't send out
a
version because I was just meddling with numbers and it's
okay. Kind
of back of the napkin look.
Got it. Okay. Cause that's where I was confused. Cause I read this thing and you said our comparison and I was confused because I didn't see anything to review. So I understood their concept.
Mm-hmm.
I think the one place that I have a question with our code, and I think it comes back to two things, like how do we allow a mix of unit sizes, like to Greg's point a little bit, if we want to do one house and an ADU, a big house and a little house or some stuff like that, how do we do that? Or let's say a house with Portland allows a house with two ADUs, for example, that our code set doesn't really contemplate something with something bigger than, if you're doing two 400 square foot things, should you be allowed to go bigger than 1200 square foot on the other one? Where this concept just caps your total building area on a lot at X. So that's the one place where I'm a little have questions with our current proposal. And then the second one with our current proposal is, in my mind, this pretty clearly says if you're building, you know, if you're building five things instead of four things, you get some benefit. And I don't know how our code, I mean, it kind of does that, but I don't know that, I guess maybe it does. So those are my two questions with the different approaches.
Yeah, with the current code, it allows more dwelling units if you do smaller dwelling units. I mean, that's the area, amount of area that it's required for a unit under 800 square feet or under is less. So doesn't prevent you from mixing in if you had say 5,000 square feet to do one large unit and two smalls, or to do three. You know, it essentially would allow, as the site size changes, to mix and match to fit your site. The FAR concept is presented here is basically it's going to allow four on no matter what size site. It's just your building's going to scale down to the point where it doesn't actually work. I mean, that's pretty much going to be the governor. What you look at in the FAR here is the current FAR is, they go to house, they actually strike the baseline FAR by 62% for a house. So they dial back in the areas that they're going to allow this. The single family detached houses is now only 30% or 40% of what the base FAR is. So that's a big discount. And then they start building it back up to the point where, you know, that if you look at the fourplex on all these, the FAR is still less than the baseline house or the existing baseline code. We have not identified any areas where we're going to mandate or dial back the baseline zone. We've only added options onto it. So that's one of the big differences between this philosophy is they didn't just take the baseline zone and build on top of it. They took the baseline zone, went to a single family home and cut it by 68%. And then they start building it back. Mm-hmm. Some of the nuance in the mathematics here. I think we heard a little bit of concern early on that if we were too restrictive on the middle housing code, people are just going to choose the full size home or the full size duplex. They're just going to go to that. So we tried to narrow the gap between the two. Now the concern would be if you go to your existing 30% lot coverage or 70% lot coverage, and you allow 28 feet, three stories, your FAR is essentially up to 2.1. And that can be a tricky proposition when it comes to how do you dial that up or down?
Yeah.
But it's an interesting philosophy of providing a bonus for the greater number of units. It just can be tricky if you don't want to start with a major haircut for one, which is the Portland infill. You can see that in place. Also, pretty much all our FARs already are greater than Portland, and I can show you how I estimated our FARs and kind of some high lows if you want to take a look at that.
Yeah, let's take a look at that.
Yeah, let's look at that.
I see Nancy has her hand raised, so while you pull that up,
okay.
Can we get her to off mute? Talking permitted, Nancy, if you want to come off mute.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Thank you.
So I will be brief. I really appreciate what you guys are doing tonight. This stuff is really hard. We lived up in Kirkland, Washington, which is close to Microsoft, and I was on the Planning Commission there in the 1990s, and we struggled as hard as you're struggling now with this. And I really appreciate your thoughtful consideration of all of Dustin's expertise and all the comments from people like us. I have one comment to make about developers. You have some great builders who have given feedback on this stuff, like Greg, I'm biased there, but Joe and Mike Kettler and people who care about the livability of the community. And just remember that developers are in it to make a profit. So when you think about what they can do with what you're considering, and Greg doesn't know I was going to say this. I didn't know I was going to say it. But there are people who will come in and max out everything they can and do things that you may not have considered. So that's where I would think, you know, Dustin's the one who has borne the brunt of people who come in and say, well, you said I can do this, so why can't I do this? And just, I would pay attention to that expertise. And the parking thing is going to kill you, and everybody's going to be mad at you when you're done with this. I just can tell you that. You have, this is no win, but God love you. You guys are doing a really good job for our community, and in 20 years, no one will remember you, but everyone will thank you. And that's all.
Thanks, Nancy. Okay, Dustin, you want to walk us through the spreadsheet?
You get to see hopefully a spreadsheet here.
Yep.
Okay, so I kind of tried to follow the similar layout to your Portland infill, looking at the idea of you know, our minimum lot size in each of our zones, which they start with in Portland, estimating what our current FAR is. That's based on your maximum lot coverages multiplied times 3. So that's where each of these come from. I went up here and I actually, I discounted that because you have to consider at least some level of parking that takes up your FAR when we start talking about lot coverage. So that needed to be discounted a little. You're never going to get, well, with required parking, you're never going to get your max FAR. You have to take some discount down. So I did that across the board. Using what your base coverage is now for each of your zones, 1.35 for your R1, 1.47 in R2, and 1.77 in R3 and C1. So I took that as the base calculation. If we use the same discount, and I call it bonus, but if you use the same discount as a Portland infill model, that dials back to again a 62% reduction right off the bat from the base FAR. So that would take it down to this 0.65 number. And then in R2 and R3, I moved them back up to the maxes. So where they would end up, they all end up, you know, around 1 or at 0.65. So my concern, I mean, one aspect of it is it certainly will take down the amount of building permitted on each lot. That's, you know, the only thing that's going to cap it is going to be your unit size. So in those areas where you have four flat or fourplex provided, that's going to, you're going to, you're going to actually probably hit the ceiling before you hit the FAR in those unit counts. So, and part of this also becomes based on your minimum lot size, you know, which in this code, there's no minimum lot size that is calculated because we take it by the entire development. So there's some, you know, we can work on the methodology of it. But there, I think you end up actually, if you take the same infill philosophy for Portland infill, you end up really driving down, you drive down your FAR altogether on all points, which when it comes to scalability and kind of compatibility, that's definitely a move in the right, in the scalability direction. You reduce the amount of a building product that can occur. When it comes to marketed competitiveness, it takes a pretty big takes a pretty big bite out of the floor area that you're going to end up being able to produce on these sites.
Do you know what the rationale was from Portland to start out with that reduction of that size? Because you just copied Portland at 62% there. Where's that number coming from?
Scrape off and big houses going in. So the first is the infill that they were seeing in Portland was, you know, the market driven infill was seeing big single family homes going in.
Yeah, they really want to cut that back. Okay.
And it was, and that's where the philosophy for this infill started coming in, is how do we both encourage a greater number of units, but also cap the ceiling on how much can be built there. So they changed the FAR. They started measuring 30 feet from the low side rather than the high side. And they started really kind of turning all those dials to reduce the overall scale of development, but incentivize the production of more dwelling units.
Yeah.
So this is where, I mean,
if they had a single family home lot and they had that big house and they scrape it off, what are the choices? They could build a regular size home, or they could do an infill project of a smaller size. Is there a benefit?
They don't get a choice. If you went back with a single family home, the areas that are zoned now, and there's certain areas of the city that became flagged for this, there's a maximum amount that you can go back.
Oh, I see. So you are incented to do multiple.
Yes.
You are incented to do two or three or four units. Got it.
Correct. But that's the adjustments on both ends that have occurred. They didn't, you know, we haven't taken the approach where we're going to rein in what the, you know, the base development is. We've just added permissible options on the other side. We haven't kind of done this. We're just working on one. We're working really on one edge where these things weren't permitted before. How would you permit them? Mm-hmm. So that it gets, again, there is some nuance to the FAR bonus from the Portland perspective.
Yeah.
So that's where...
For us, using this methodology the way you just spelled it out here, Dustin, would result in a higher probability of fewer units in some cases, right?
No, I think a developer wouldn't touch the site unless they built more. They would build two or three units.
Right. If you disincentivized the single family so much by basically taking it and cutting it by 68%, I would be very surprised if someone came in and
built a single family.
I mean, that'd just be.
Mm-hmm.
And what's wrong with that?
It's just a policy choice to reduce the base zoning permissibility.
Sorry, Megan, you're saying what's wrong with that in terms of ending up with a smaller unit or ending up wanting people to do more than one unit?
So maybe I misunderstood, but this model here disincentivizes single family home creation?
Not this, not what we're looking at now, but the Portland. We want to flip back to the Portland model. So the point is, in the Portland model, they took a single family home. I'll just make up a number. Could be 2,000 square feet. Now you cannot build a 2,000 square feet single family home. If it's going to be a single family or one building, one home, one residence on that lot, you can now only build 1,200 square feet, some number 60%, 40% less.
Isn't that I thought that was a good thing.
That's a great thing. If you want to build affordable housing, if developers feel kind and they want to build one lot, one building.
I mean, that would avoid the whole tear down thing where houses are being torn down to build something bigger.
That's the point. Yep. Okay. For sure.
Yeah, I don't think it's just not the approach that this was started on by taking what would be the buildable rights of the bottom, or not the bottom, the buildable rights of an existing base zone and reducing those. It was only thinking about adding additional options onto that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not advocating that policy. That's just the direction that we took, is not to reduce what is permitted as the base zone, but adding on other options. That was the philosophy.
Dustin, could we go look at your code matrix side-by-side thing that you sent? Because I think some of this with our thinking of cottage concept, I mean, the thing that I was hoping that we could get out of it is if you built smaller things, you can get more of them. And I think we have accomplished that, right? So if you're building something that's under 800 square feet or whatever our cottage is, I mean, I would say we should revisit this table and have the concept of a cottage in there.
So I hope you see the table.
Yes.
Yeah.
So with the draft that came within the R1 didn't change based on your suggestion. That was one dwelling at every 2,500, regardless of size. So on a single family lot of or an R1 lot, you would end up with two permissible dwelling units, whether it's a single family dwelling of any size plus an ADU, or two middle housing products that cap at 1,500 square feet with a garage. In R2, we get a little more granular, and then you end up with one dwelling for every 1,250 square feet for those units that are 800 and less, and then one dwelling per 1,500 square feet if they're between 800 and 1,000. So that's where your cottage would fall. If you, with 1,000 square feet, it would be on the larger side of the middle housing code. Whereas now you're basically, the density mix now is 1 to 2,500. So you split that in two different tiers below that, saying if you went to a middle housing code, it's 1 to 1,500. If you went to the smaller end of the middle housing code, it's 1 to 1,250. So that would be, Bill, for your illustrative, 1 to 1,250 would be like a Sager density I think it's 7th Street, was that at that rate.
Joel's.
Yes.
One, Joel Knutson, yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
And that carries suit into the R3, the same kind of strata of the smaller dwelling units. If your dwelling units are under 800 square feet, it's 1 to 1,250. If they're between 800 and 1,200, then they're 1 to 1,500.
So let me.
We've broken this down a little by incentivizing or allowing a greater number of units per air. No, we measure it per area, not just FAR for the building.
Well, I guess that's my question here. So what is 800 square feet measured by and the 8 to 1200 square feet measured by? I was understanding that was floor area. No?
Yeah.
So should we be saying floor area or all square footages in the table are refer to floor area or something?
Yeah. Yeah, that I would interchange those. So square feet.
Okay.
It would be the floor measured 800 square feet in floor area. Just our font starts getting really small when we start. And I use this just as tracking side by side, not necessarily for I would take this and remove it for code purposes rather than side by side.
So my only question.
Floor area really means footprint here, not floor area of the building.
Not footprint, floor area.
Floor area.
Okay.
This makes sense to me. The question I have is going back to the, how do we allow anything? Do we allow mix of big and small? And so that's my one question. And then the other one is, how do we deal with Greg's weird split where we're 500 square feet short of doing something on an R1 lot? Those would be my two comments for discussion.
So for this, I think this is intended to allow you would, if you wanted to do a mix of these, I think you would add up your dwellings based on size, and that would determine your area. Or if you wanted to reverse out of the area, you could do, you know, you may be in a situation where you can do two dwellings between 800 and 1200 and one dwelling 800 and less, depending on the area. So for example, if you had 6,500 square feet, or excuse me, 7,500 square feet in an R1 zone, you could do three full-size units. In R2, if you ended up with, you could do if you had a 4,250 square foot lot by some shape, you could do two of the full size middle dwelling units and then a one under 800. That's how you would fit it in.
Okay, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But you would need 4,500 square feet to do three of the larger middle dwelling units. But if you ended up with 4,200 or 4,250, you would end up with, you couldn't have three full-size ones or middle-size ones. You'd have two full-size and one smaller if you wanted to do the max.
Okay, that makes sense. So that I understand that. Then my only other question is back to the 7,000 square foot lot. And should we talked about this once and we said two, but Greg kind of is raising the point of should we allow something different, and maybe we don't, we already debated it and we don't need to, but
yep.
I think I
know Mark's opinion.
Yeah. Well, I wrote this and I provided this to Greg too. When we started this discussion with city council, one of my asks to them was, this relates to House Bill 2001. You're not a mandatory adoption community. Mm-hmm. And the ask was, did you want to consider the idea of allowing a duplex or two units in the R1 zone? It's not required now, probably within 5 to 7 years it would be. And the feedback that I received and some of the direction there was, well, we allow a single family home and an ADU today. Is there really that big of a jump from going from one single family home and an ADU to two middle housing cottages or two middle housing units? And that delta wasn't that big, or it was an acceptable evaluation. It wasn't something that they wanted us to review that. So now moving from that to, well, what if we allow a duplex and an ADU? That's a little bigger it's a little bigger jump than what we initially, or what I initially crafted for this, based on that feedback.
I missed the part of the Planning Commission discussion on the ADU, nixing that. And I should have gone back and looked at the minutes and reviewed them, but I didn't. What was the overall consensus on not allowing?
It's just covered as a dwelling unit.
We already dealing
accessory. An ADU is 800 square feet or less, and we kind of cover that in the dwellings for 800 square feet or less.
Okay.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be accessory to anything. It can be a standalone 800 square feet, whereas today an ADU must be accessory to another product. This allows a similar structure of the same size to be, in its own right, a fee simple, purchasable, sellable lot, sellable structure. And that was my rationale for how it got organized. Do you want me to stop sharing this so you can go back to a full discussion? Just cue me when you
want. Well, I'm trying to figure what we want to try and resolve with this. So what you're saying is you have somewhat achieved what Portland has done without needing to use floor area. Well, you have floor areas in here, but without sort of the FAR conversation, we basically have the idea of scaling built into this.
Yeah, they just have, the difference would be they have an unlimited, really, you could use an FAR on any site of any size to get a scale. We put a little more sidebars on this to use the area of the lot as part of the driver, as part of the determining factor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're limited. Their FAR would work for a four unit on any lot until it got to the point where the structure itself just couldn't function. We've kind of done away with the minimum lot size itself and allowing projects to be built on a project by project or a larger project unit basis. But that's required. It kind of takes away from some of the FAR conversation. Mm-hmm. It makes it a little more complicated. No. And we haven't discounted anything for a single family home. You know, there's been no Portland infill discount. That's also part of the, again, what part of the philosophy of what they have chosen to do, and the approach that makes the FAR escalator probably a little more scalable and palatable.
I think what worries me a little bit about this chart, And it's hard to see it by looking at these numbers, but when you drew those pictures a few weeks ago, what I was hoping the Portland table would do would be more about this concept of, as you add more units, the units get smaller, the overall footprint on the site is not as severe. Whereas here, when you add more dwellings, it's yet another dwelling at 2550 or yet another dwelling at 2550 until you need to squeeze in that 800. You know what I mean? It's like there are these units that just keep piling in. It feels a lot more dense, this diagram. And I'm also concerned, by the way, so you have 30% lot coverage, right? We 30% lot coverage shown in R1. Or an alternate of 40%, and then in R2, 30% with alternate of 35. You know, going back to those diagrams you drew, 30% is basically your setbacks, and the rest can be building. I think that's pretty scary to me.
Yeah, and that's why I introduced the alternates. If you wanted to move on that, yeah, essentially R1 and R2 are basically your landscape area. That 30% landscape is essentially the setback. Everything else becomes buildable or parkable. Mm-hmm. And if there was some, if you felt like that was too much and you wanted to mandate some internal landscaping or something, that's where the alternate comes in. Mm-hmm. So it would add, for example, you know, in R1, another 700 square feet of open space. In the R2, it would add another 250 feet to just about the size of a parking space, a little more on the inside, outside the setback. So. I think there was a little bit of sticker shock when, you know, in the R3 zone, the alternate or the landscape area is about the same. When we were shown a 22% possible open space or non-built area reduction in R1, that became a little bit, I think that felt a little significant. Mm-hmm. Or that was my read based upon your feedback.
All right, we're at the top of the hour, and then some.
I'll comment. Yeah. I'm comfortable with the proposed alternate. I build in setback to setback to setback on some of these. I mean, I don't think we would ever have it, because I'm trying to figure out how you would fit four units together and actually build something that would do that. But I'm okay with requiring some additional green space in some of those other zones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm in agreement with that.
Yeah, I agree with that too.
So recommendation would be to pick the alternates.
Alternate, yeah.
Okay. And then in terms of FAR to kind of our, I guess I'd call it area to unit ratio, having a graduated is still acceptable route?
Yeah, I think it is. I just don't, if I look at, so what am I looking at? R2 PC revisions, we're at 1250 in R2 with the, so you're either 1250, no, well, 1500, 1250 or 800.
Oh, sorry. Let me slide this over a little bit.
I'm just looking at that white column, R2 PC mm-hmm. revision. So we're at, I still feel like I want to see the number of, okay, what does that actually end, what does that end up looking like? What is, if you have a 5,000 square foot lot, you're going to end up with two 1250s and one 800?
Yep. So that could be a duplex and what would appear to be an ADU type mm-hmm. building, which would be a standalone structure. You could end up with three cottages.
And if you did four, you're probably going to be, can you do four 1250s?
That would be four 800 square foot or less buildings.
Okay.
Four, I would call that on the, well, not necessarily micro scale. That would be four cottages.
Mm-hmm. And that's only if the lot size is
5,000.
5,000. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. The likelihood of being able to have four freestanding buildings on one 5,000 square foot lot is pretty impossible. Mm-hmm. You would end up having some sort of attached dwelling or two stack duplexes of something of that sort. There's just not enough real estate to get 0.75 parking spaces, building setbacks on there. It doesn't work. But what happens is if you end up with a 6,000 square foot site, now you can end up with four buildings, some parking. It does have to scale a little bit. I think if you look at the minimum lot size, even three cottages is going to be a is going to be a challenge on that, just because of, you know, we have the turnaround, we have the rate. It just makes it, it makes it mathematically possible. Add in topography and availability and utilities, and it becomes, you know, it's mathematically available, probably a pretty challenge to fit those on there.
I have one question. It seems like we've gone into the weeds on this stuff. We got some pretty good consensus on things. We have a code set that's somewhat evolved. Is this the point where we can hand it over to some people to test fit it? Is that our plan?
Yeah, this is where I want to see, I was hoping for a recommendation to get it to council and see what, because I, every time I test fit it, well, I could test fit it for, we started that in the beginning. I kind of want to land on a recommendation, so when I pay for a test fit, I know what it is.
I would certainly like to see what these look like on a 5,000 foot lot, or if it was an oversized lot, you know, how does this end up scaling is, I think, the issue that I see.
Well, and that's kind of where we came from, the prototypes. Mm-hmm. I mean, prototypes that we started with, mm-hmm. you know, that was also with they fit into that format, yeah. But you end up with more attached products. You know, if you want to try to do more than 3 on 5,000, they end up being attached dwellings. I mean, that's what it comes down to. So that's where it becomes the triplex, you know, triplex or 2 attached and 1 detached. That's really what the configurations start to look like.
Mm-hmm. You need a motion so we can go home.
Yeah.
Or we're home, but shut off our Zoom. So you made we have a bunch of code changes that we talked about today, Dustin, right?
Yep.
Like revisions to what you've provided. And what do you think the timeline is and next steps for doing something?
Well, I would craft them up as your recommendation, because I feel like I got consensus on each individual piece, or where there was an impasse, I have that. I would craft that up as a recommendation and provide it to and to council, saying, here's the Planning Commission's work on the code.
Okay. And that you would present that to them at their next meeting?
It would be at their... I believe it's March 8th, next month.
That's probably 3 weeks.
March 8th meeting. So I would need to have it produced before that. It wouldn't just show up at that meeting. So I would definitely send it. I'd send it out the week before that.
Okay.
So I could have that all crafted, and I'd be happy to move that along with the commentary. I would clean up the code based on where we landed. I would probably put some commentary boxes in there based on this meeting. I'm going to have to definitely go back and re-listen on where we where we landed on these. But I would share that with you as what kind of the consolidated recommendation and or impasse points were. If you're all comfortable with that.
That sounds good.
Yeah, I'm good.
Sounds good by me. Yep.
Thank you. Thank you all. One last thing.
Do we need a motion on this? I think.
Oh yeah.
Please. Are we continuing, or are we? What are we doing here? I guess that's.
I would ask for one clarification as the note taker.
Definitely.
You talked about being comfortable with the additional percentage for landscaping in the matrix. And it wasn't clear to me if you were talking about all zones or just R1 and R2.
I think it was the alternates for R1 and R2, correct?
R3 didn't have an alternate, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think I was looking for a motion for recommendation to move this. I feel like you guys have dialed it in. I know where the gaps are and where I'm going to need someone to break the impasse of 3 to 3.
Yep. So I guess the question I have is, it seems like process-wise, it would be really nice to before, I mean, so if this is going to be an ordinance, are we going to have another hearing on the final form of it?
Yeah. Well, council has to have a hearing on it. So
yeah, I'm just wondering if we do.
It's the ordinance. Yes.
Do we have another hearing on it or not? That's my question for you.
Oh yeah. If you send it on as recommendation, Planning Commission would not have another hearing on it.
Got it. Okay. The place where I am a little, I'd say the lack of comfort for me in that particular point is, I feel like it would be nice to have, and maybe it's just we just give up that, but it'd be nice to have the building community take this code set and actually try and do something with it and see it, that it has a positive outcome. Because I'd hate to, we're doing this a little bit in a vacuum, and then we're getting some feedback from those guys, but it'd be nice to actually take a couple lots and stick this on it and see what they would build and see if the economics of it all work before we say council, we can put our stamp of approval on this. I don't know what other people's comments are. Anyone else?
I think that's a good idea because it may delay the whole process at most a month, it sounds like. Is that the time frame with I'm thinking of? Is that realistic? Because I know the feedback that we've gotten from people, I really depend a lot on those developer comments we've gotten so far. So just confirmation of how this works would be great.
Yes, I would rather them spend 3 months test fitting than us spend 3 months talking.
What's your comment there, Dustin?
Yeah, I believe in the test fit. I feel like we started with the test fit and we had some refinements based upon those developers' feedback. So if we keep moving it around, I feel like we're never gonna get there. I think we've had some issues raised by various people on what they needed to move. And I feel like we've addressed most of them. But at some point, I think we do have to go with it too. I mean, and go and see what works and what doesn't based on some field. I don't think we've done it in a total vacuum. So I'm comfortable with the recommendation based on, I mean, I feel like I'm probably less comfortable with the predictability factor and probably all the wiggle room and flexibility we have. So see, that's on my end, is how do I make sure that we don't over flexible this and we don't have predictable outcome. Somebody's going to make something to work with this, because I think the sidebars are so, you know, it is such flexibility, you know, the landscape, the open space area being reduced to almost setbacks. We're back to building height. We've allowed a density increase in a lot of ways. I don't see how you could not do something with it. I mean, so I think we've given a lot of thought to those things. I think the parking area part is a challenge, and I think you faced it just as the development community will. But I'm pretty comfortable setting it up. And I have, once we got to a recommendation point, I definitely intended to do more test fits with it. I just can't keep having test fits and then we tweak it and then test fit again. I mean, and for the sake of our development community too, like, we're kind of going to the well and requesting favors from them to help vet this. I, you know, as they continue to vet it and we keep tweaking it, it is, yeah, I want to be sensitive to that too, to our volunteers, just like you volunteers. So mm-hmm. for volunteering your night. But I'm pretty comfortable it will work.
I guess my
also believe in coming back to it. So
yeah, my comment would be is I'd like to see, I think it would be useful for council to be able to make a decision on this if they have some economic information that goes along with it. So I'm comfortable making a recommendation to push this on, but I want a package to go to council that says, based on this code, developer XYZ over here could build something like this. This is what the cost of the units would be. This is what the cost of the land would be. This is what the sale price of the units would be here.
My only issue, and not to open up a can of worms at 8:21 at night, is that, you know, I wonder if, I'm not going to say any of this is economically viable, but, you know, I think we have this idea that we want to try and achieve some type of affordability. And I'm worried that, you know, we can't get there alone through the Planning Commission, right? There's no amount of numbers of doors that we're going to put on a 5,000 square foot site that's going to make it meet some level of affordability. And so by doing those test fits, you know, they might look at it and say, well, it doesn't pencil out, which is maybe good to know now. But from the city commission, city council, I mean, there's got to be some ownership that they would take, right, in terms of taxes or fees or in lieu or this or that, right, that helps us get to where we want to get to. And so, you know, by asking the community, the developer community, to kind of beat this up, I worry the answer is going to be, it doesn't pencil out. and then, you know, we still need to go to council and say, you need to help.
Yeah, I think one of the early things that we ask, and I think we've had some feedback on the development community, you know, and I think Bill mentioned anything's going to sell. I think that's, you know, that's the issue. It's just making sure that, you know, in some ways not having such a big gap between different products the development community never embraces this or never takes an opportunity to do it, regardless of what it comes in at, because it's going to come in expensive. It's only more affordable by way of size. It certainly, I wouldn't expect it to be affordable with a capital A. This is going to be a market driven product. And I think we have to temper some expectations based on that. This is going to be a market delivered product. So that is, you know, I wouldn't want to fool you into thinking otherwise. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah, it's not going to deliver us 80 to 120 AMI product. Right. Itself.
Yes. Right. Itself in it without something else. It's, you know, I think we're under a pretty clear expectation that code alone is not going to deliver this an affordable housing product. It's going to have to be coupled with other things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
But I'd be happy to craft it up and to send it back to you two for review. I think that's important based upon what I would see as a recommendation.
Okay.
We don't necessarily have to have a hearing for that, but I definitely would want to make sure it reflected your...
Okay, so you'll draft up a new version. You'll send it to us. We'll do that in advance of, I think I heard you say, March 6th meeting?
Well, City Council will be March 8th, so... For you, I would just send it back as advisory.
Yeah.
And please flag it if it doesn't reflect your, that's, I want to make sure that it reflected what came out of this and what we pulled out of the minutes.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Mr. Ehring, do you want to make a motion?
I'll make a motion that with the amendments to the code set discussed today, that the, do we have a file number for this thing?
That's 2020-37.
That we recommend approval of the code set for file 2020-37 to City Council.
I second that.
All right, we have a motion by Bill to move this along with the changes as determined. We have a second, Megan. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Bill?
Well, I made the motion, so I don't think I
have to. Oh, okay. Aye.
I could say aye.
All right. Chair votes aye. Motion passes. Before we go. There's some meeting minutes from February 1st. Anybody want to make a motion to approve the meeting minutes? February 1st?
I'll make the motion to approve the minutes from February 1st.
All right. We have a motion from Megan to approve the minutes. Do we have a second?
Yeah, I'll second that.
Sue, a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Bill? Chair votes aye. Motion passes. All right. I think we're good.
Get ready for a TSP. Come right up.
TSP on first time in first weekend March. All right.
Thanks for your
attention. All right. Have a good evening.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Thank you.